Welcome to Stories in the Key of Light. I'm Jen Mangloss.
And I'm Monica Rumig Green. We're a podcast that talks about themes that speak to Christian spirituality in film across genres.
Today we're talking about the 1940 film The Philadelphia Story, directed by George Cukor and starring Katharine Hepburn, Cary Grant, and Jimmy Stewart. So a bunch of nobodies. So we're not holding back from any spoilers in this podcast. We encourage you to watch the film. If you haven't already, since this has been out since the 40s, you've had some time. You can rent this on a variety of streaming sites or go to your mom or grandma's house. She might just own it.
Oh, yeah, I do.
I own it, too.
Oh, man. Ugh. This film. Jen.
Well, let's jump ahead to initial observations, because I'm sensing that there's an attachment for you.
A little bit of attachment for me. Yeah, a little bit. I honestly don't remember the first time I saw this film, because I've seen it so many times. I grew up as a little kid being a fan of old films, like black and white films, musicals, Fred and Ginger, that kind of thing. Particularly Cary Grant films, since I was very, very young. I have loved Cary Grant so much that when I was 12, I went to see him live while he was doing a series of talks called An Evening with Cary Grant.
That's impressive.
He was in his 80s, Jen, and I was such a fangirl and had such a big crush on him, I sat in the third row and raised my hand to ask a question. Something about him not smiling in photos or something, but I just wanted him to talk to me.
So, can you do a good impression of him? He's got such a distinctive voice.
Not at all. I can't. Oh, man. He's just, I don't know.
Actually, it's funny. All three of the people in this movie have such distinctive speaking styles between Katharine Hepburn, Jimmy Storr.
Yes. And oh, my gosh. They're all iconic, right?
I'm awful at doing impressions of them.
Oh, my gosh. This is what's incredible. Is when I tell people about this film, like, you have to see this film, all I say is, listen, people, it has these three people in it. They're the headliners of this film. What more do you need to know? Put together in a jar and stir, right? But, you know, again, I love practically everything Cary Grant's ever touched, but The Philadelphia Story has long been like a long favorite of mine, so much so that I realized on this last showing when I decided to watch it again, like, I'm quoting the lines before they come up because I'm so excited to hear them. But honestly, it wasn't until about 15 years ago that this movie, particularly Tracy's storyline of growing in her own self-awareness, it got really personal for me. Mm. It's like I watched it from a completely different perspective, and that was the movie that I said, no, this film, it's the co-number one film of my heart.
What's the other one?
It's kind of odd. This is Spinal Tap. And I doubt there's anything we could say about This is Spinal Tap.
Except that would have, it's an 11?
It goes to 11. That's all I have to say. But they're very different films, no question. But what they both have is a playfulness about them. So is this a perfect film? No, this isn't a perfect film. We'll cover some of the issues that have not aged well. Mm-hmm. But it has always had my heart. I love it so much that I have toyed with an idea to take a line from this film and have it put on my gravestone.
Wait, what?
Yeah, it's kind of crazy.
That's the fangirling.
That's really fangirling. But wouldn't it be great if somebody walked across the cemetery and stumbled upon this gravestone, had a name and dates, and said right underneath it, "My, she was Yar."
So could you advise them on how to say that? Because I feel like if you're saying Yar, you have to go Yar.
My, she was Yar. Yes.
Hold on that R.
And remember, what that means is living up to the kind of person who deserves that kind of praise. So in the film, a boat that is Yar is easy to handle, quick to the helm, fast, bright, everything a boat should be. Mm-hmm. So to say, my, she was Yar, I mean, I'd have to live up to that, to put that on my gravestone, but yeah, that's how much I like this movie.
I don't remember the first time I saw this film either, but I came to it a little later. I think it was in my 20s. I hadn't grown up watching many of her films, Katharine Hepburn. Okay, and truth be told, I wasn't initially a fan of hers.
No.
I know. I found her voice really annoying, which I realize now is a very petty comment, but that was me when I was younger. And I was more of a fan of Audrey Hepburn, surprisingly.
Oh, no. Well, which, grace and elegance.
Yeah, but the older I get, the more I realize, no, it's Katharine who's
she's
the powerhouse.
Got the fire.
Yeah. She's, when you know more about her, and if you get more of the context, you know, the time period she was in, what she did was pretty breathtaking.
Yes.
So I'm late, but I've come to the Katharine party. I really love her work, and this film in particular is one of my favorites, alongside with Bringing Up Baby.
Oh.
Which is another Cary Grant.
Cary Screwball, exactly.
But it's so fun. And yes. She does Screwball well. In watching it again, I really found the film's exploration of social class interesting.
Yes.
Yeah, and the three men Tracy is drawn to give a glimpse of men across the socioeconomic spectrum. Because
uh-huh.
you have George, her fiancé.
Yeah.
You know, he comes from nothing, but he seeks to gain everything. Mm-hmm. He's very conscious about his image.
Upwardly mobile.
Very upwardly mobile. And then there's Dexter, who came from privilege. He may have fallen on some hard times. That's actually a little hard to tell because there's... They say that he's doing the story for money, but it comes out he's actually doing the story to help her.
Right.
He seems to be doing okay.
He went through personal hard times, not necessarily financial
hard times. Mm-hmm. His house is still pretty nice.
Yeah.
And then there's Mike, who came from nothing, and he revels in his humble beginnings. And he's very resistant to anything that smells of money.
Yes.
And so you have these three men with very different trajectories.
Yes.
And it's interesting to watch that. Now, there's a lot more that could be said about social class, and this film doesn't address that. But I think for the time period, it's pretty insightful. And I love the names in this movie.
Oh, gosh, aren't they fantastic?
Which sounds like a weird observation, but, man, C.K. Dexter Haven! Sorry, this is my awful Jimmy Stewart impression. This is actually what goes through my head whenever I think about the Philadelphia story is that moment.
Oh, everybody calls out C.K. Dexter Haven. It's one of the greatest things ever.
Yeah. Well, and then the other thing I noticed this time is there's a scene with Little Sebastian. Okay. So it wasn't Little Sebastian from Parks and Rec. For any of our Parks and Rec fans out there,
you
get the Little Sebastian reference. But I can't see miniature horses without thinking about Little Sebastian. And it's a little awkward that her younger
Dinah,
her younger sister, has this miniature horse and cart, like a wicker basket cart. Different time.
different times, different amount of money.
Different amount of money. But anyways, I was very happy with that realization of, hey, it looks like Little Sebastian. So anyways, any of my Parks and Rec fans will enjoy that.
Absolutely.
But shall we move on to our favorite part
of
the podcast, where we talk about the spiritual themes that we notice?
Again, this is the kind of movie that I think people would be surprised that we would say, there are incredible spiritual themes in the Philadelphia story, but this is one of the reasons why it is so meaningful to my heart. You know, Luke 7, Luke 7, there's many stories in Luke 7, but the one at the end of that chapter is the story of what they call the Pharisee and the sinful woman. So Jesus is having dinner with a Pharisee. And while he's there, the sinful woman comes and washes his feet.
Yeah.
It's not Mary later doing it. It's another time. She's washing his feet. And Jesus can sense the Pharisee is judging her. And so he tells this story. He says, there were two men that owed this guy. One owed this guy a lot of money, and one owed this guy a little bit of money. And the man who was owed the money forgave the debt of both. Which one of them would love him more? And of course the Pharisee says, I suppose the guy who owed the most amount of money. To which Jesus says, exactly, and shows how the Pharisee was not treating Jesus with the respect that this quote-unquote sinful woman was.
Yeah.
And the fact that she was doing all these things to honor him and respect him, like washing his feet. And he says, essentially, he who is forgiven much loves much, and he who is forgiven little loves little. That, to me, is what this story is about for Tracy. So Tracy Lord, the heroine of this film, this is her awakening to this reality. She believes that keeping herself pure and strong and righteous in the right all the time was the way to keep herself safe as a human. And it's working out mostly fine for her. She's getting ready to get married again. And her ex-husband, played by Cary Grant, there's this absolutely shocking scene, if you think about it, in this film, this light, frothy comedy where they do bicker and they get on one another, but then the bickering turns very sharp.
Mm-hmm.
And he tells her the truth of what he sees in her, that her disdain for weakness in herself and in others keeps her from being as fully human as she could be. This is the exact line. I had to pull them off of the internet. He calls her Red. I just love that. Because he's constantly trying to humanize her, right? They keep saying she's beautiful, she's talented.
She's a goddess.
She's right. She's rich. She's got everything that a woman could desire. But he's constantly calling her Red. They grew up together as kids, right? So he says, Dexter says to her, Red, you could be the finest woman on this earth. I'm contemptuous of something inside of you you either can't help or make no attempt to, your so-called strength, your prejudice against weakness, your blank intolerance. And she says, is that all? And she says it, classic Katharine Hepburn, just such contemptuousness when she says it. Mm-hmm. And he says, that's the gist of it. Because you'll never be a first-class human being or a first-class woman until you've learned to have some regard for human frailty. It's a pity your own foot can't slip it a little sometime. But your sense of inner divinity wouldn't allow that. This goddess must and shall remain intact.
A little bit of foreshadowing in that line, too. Your foot slipping a little.
Right? Well, and that's the point. Like, he's setting it up, what her experience is going to be, but he's the first one to tell her, Tracy, you think you have it all, but there's something in you that broke our marriage. And it is spiritual because he likens it that she thinks she's a goddess. Now, if you think about Christian spirituality, the original sin was that we wanted to be like God. Mm. And so to keep herself pure and godlike keeps her above everyone else and keeps her separate from the frailty of humanity. And then when she has this awakening from him, like that starts with Dexter, that also reminds me of Proverbs 27:6, which is that faithful are the wounds of a friend, profuse are the kisses of an enemy. Hmm. Dexter is very harsh with Tracy, but he's telling her this because he loves her. You know that he actually loves her and sees her. Having been married to her, he knows her character more intimately than most of the people around. And this is what's such a great about this script, is he leaves, and then her fiancé shows up, and he tells her the exact same thing, but he says that he revels in that. That's what he loves about her. It's something he admires, not disdains. Ugh. Right? And she has this great moment where she says, but I don't want to be worshipped. I want to be loved. Mm-hmm. And you believe it. But when he says this, he's verifying everything that Dexter just said.
Oh, yeah.
Just boom, boom, one right after the other. It's just an absolutely brilliant script.
Oh, it is. And you know what's interesting, though? Having her faults told to her, or at least this is what's stopping you from being loved the way you want to. Mm-hmm. That wasn't enough, though. It Mm-mm. was the moment when she drinks too much.
That's right. She has to have her own fall.
Yeah, and her character comes into question that there really is a transformation.
Yes.
So she needs to experience her own human frailty. And as she realizes this, her words ring through. I'm going to quote another line,
please
too.
Please do.
Because, yeah, it is such a great script. That she says, I'm such an unholy mess of a girl.
Oh, I just love that.
Oh, it's such a perfect line. Because she's not a goddess. But she is a flesh and blood girl. And she's good at hiding and masking what she feels.
Yes.
And her fiancé, George, even comments on how detached she is. Mm-hmm. So he says that's a positive.
Yeah.
You know, and so she's good at that hiding until her life blows up.
Yeah.
And what's cool is, really soon after, you know, everything falls apart, and there's a moment when she's reading George's letter.
George, her fiancé.
George, yeah. Her fiancé. And she's telling him, or he's telling her, that he's calling off the engagement. And this really cold, formal letter.
Yes.
Like, yes. It feels like a form letter where it's like, dear, insert name. Thank you for the honor of. And she teases that out a little bit. So when she's reading that letter, and she starts to read it out loud, Liz and Mike start to back away as she begins to read it. Like, oh, we shouldn't be here for this. And she actually beckons them to listen.
Yep.
And that's when you know things have changed, because she's no longer trying to hide.
Yes.
Hide her shame. The mask really is down. And it goes another level further because she does a speech to the wedding guests.
Yes.
She doesn't let her mom or dad make the announcement the wedding's off. She goes off to make that announcement herself.
Because Dexter tells her she's had every blow softened for her, and she decides that's not going to be to her good anymore.
Yeah, and so there's something beautiful that she's able to be honest and vulnerable mm-hmm. with these, you know, the
upper crust.
Yeah.
The upper crust of Philadelphia society.
Yeah, and because she sees her frailty and no longer tries to hide it, she can truly receive and give love.
Yes.
And what happens next? She gets married.
She gets married to Dexter.
And she says, I feel like a human mm-hmm. being. And you're like, yeah, that's what was supposed to happen.
Yeah, and her father says, you look like a goddess, which is not her intention.
Yeah.
So it also speaks to that kind of redemptive moment when we are our most human, when we are allowing ourselves to be loved, we become more than we ever intended. So instead of trying to be hold ourselves apart like a goddess, she's shining.
Yeah.
She's shining like something otherworldly because she's receiving love.
Yeah. because she's being vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm often amazed at the lengths God will go in order to sanctify us.
Oh, yeah.
To remove us from ways of life that bring death and destruction. There's a Sufjan Stevens song called Seven Swans, and there's this line in there that always resonates with me, and it goes, "He will take you. If you run, he will chase you, because he is the Lord." Which is, in some moments, a really comforting thought. In some moments, a really frustrating thought. Think if we're honest, right?
Right.
God doesn't always intervene in such big ways. Mm-hmm. There are times when he allows our sin to continue. But then there are these moments when he shows up, almost like a burning bush.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing is the same.
Right.
And so often he uses the people in our life to show us what's going on in our hearts, to mirror back what we can't or won't see ourselves.
You know, one of the things I like about this movie is that everybody is going through transformation. All these major characters are. Dex, you get the sense, went through his transformation when he went to the sanitarium for his alcoholism.
Yeah.
Right? He's been a broken man. So he's sort of leading the way. Ruth Hussey's character, Liz.
She's so good.
Okay. She's honestly who I've always wanted to be is her. Like, she's so cool. But she's broken too. She has a former marriage, a man who beat her. You know, Joe Smith, he was a complete rat, she says. So she's kind of sadder but wiser as well.
And she's in this relationship that's very ambiguous with
Mike. With Macaulay, right? So with Mike. So the people that need to change, who need to grow as they have grown, are Mike and Tracy. Mm-hmm. And so we've talked about Tracy's transformation, but Mike goes through a transformation as well.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is his defensiveness against the upper class, you know, anything that has money, he's just so, again, it's about disdain, right? He's so disdainful against them that he's not even willing to see them as human.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't until he sees Tracy reading his book in the library and he softens, and she picks up on him. She tells him who he is, and they develop this sweet little relationship.
Well, they get each other.
They get each other. They're both hiding.
Mm-hmm.
They're both hiding. They both put on a front of strength when underneath there's this tender place. And so they have to have this moment together in order both of them to grow up and grow into new people. And I love when Liz says at the end, she's like, don't get too sentimental on me all at once, right? Like, she can see that Mike has grown, and she's so wise because she's talking to Dexter about, he says, why aren't you married to Mike? And she says, he still has some growing up to do, basically. He needs to figure some things out. And she says, and I'll just keep waiting until it happens. And it does. And so you get the sense that it's not going to be long until Mike and Liz are together as well. So this is what makes it such a romantic comedy, is you get two love affairs in one and a little bit of mix between the two. But if Mike and Tracy hadn't had that moment, they helped each other unlock something in the other that needed to be broken.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting when movies have those type of moments where there's some people who come into our life who the connection is supposed to be long-lasting. It's supposed to be, you know, a marriage or just a long friendship. And there's some people who come into our life and they're catalysts for us.
Yes.
And the movie Once shows this really well, where they're catalysts for each other. They're both stuck. But the intention isn't for them to end up long-term together.
No.
Like, they actually need to go back to the people they were with originally.
Right.
And there's something for them there. And so there's that similar quality between Tracy and Mike, that they're catalysts for each other. They're bringing about growth and transformation for each other, but not for the end purpose of them being together.
No, not at all. And it's so wonderful. And he does the right thing, too. Like, he even proposes, which is what he had not been wanting to do with Liz. Like, that's the sign of his growth. He's proposing. It's just so sweet. The whole movie's so sweet. Well, not everything. There's some things that don't work about this film, but let's talk about what does work. Let's look at the film craft now. The script is so smart and sophisticated. The dialogue is witty and sharp. The performances are spot on. There is chemistry going on between all three stars.
Yes.
They each have their own chemistry. It simply crackles. I think my very favorite pairing is actually between Cary Grant and Jimmy Stewart.
Absolutely.
They are having the time of their life, and I just want to be in that room while Jimmy Stewart is drunk. And they're so much fun. They have a cagey playfulness. the direction, George Cukor, he knew how to direct a film.
Yeah.
Everything is at the perfect tone, the perfect pacing. It's quick, it's fast, it's fun. It's just this little gem of a film. It's like it takes you into this world. And I think the further away we get from it, the more it's incredible how quickly you drop into this world that is so other from us.
Yeah.
Now. 1940s Philadelphia high society is not my world, but you get it right at the beginning.
You mentioned the chemistry between Jimmy Stewart and Cary Grant.
Too beautiful.
And yeah, that scene when Mike is drunk, that stood out to me in my most recent time watching it. The way they play off each other is just fantastic. Seeing Jimmy Stewart play drunk is just a hoot.
Yes.
I mean,
yes. He's very good at it.
He is. I could watch that for hours. And Cary Grant plays the perfect straight man in that moment. Yes, like he just, Jimmy Stewart's performance is elevated by what Cary Grant offers in that moment.
You know, I actually had a moment this time, and this might sound like blasphemy to some people, but I could envision a remake of this film with George Clooney and Brad Pitt.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they have that kind of playfulness.
Yep.
And it came out in this.
100%. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. No, and we see that in movies like Ocean's 11.
Yeah, exactly.
That, I mean, which makes that movie work so well is because of the chemistry they have.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. You know, I watch this movie and I find myself wishing I could talk like the characters in this film. And it reminds me of the smartness of writers I enjoy right now, modern writers like Aaron Sorkin and Amy Sherman-Palladino. And you have to wonder if it was films like this that trained and inspired them.
Absolutely.
Because that same wittiness, even though it's modernized,
right?
You know, it makes sense somewhat within our time period. Even though it always feels a little dated, there's that quickness and wittiness
Absolutely.
That I find in the writing. And it makes me think back to films like Philadelphia Story.
And His Girl Friday.
I mean,
there's a whole bunch of these kind of films where they assumed that the audience could keep up.
Yeah.
And it took a while, but actually it's interesting that you picked out Aaron Sorkin and Amy Sherman-Palladino because they're television writers first and foremost, right?
Yeah.
And television was the one that picked up recently that, no, we don't have to talk down to the audience. We can make things fast and quick and people will keep up.
Although Aaron Sorkin actually got a start in theater.
And guess what?
This was a play originally.
All these were plays originally.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So,
Thank you, theater world.
And I keep coming back to this drunk scene, but there's a moment when Mike exclaims, C.K. Dexter Haven, you have unexpected depth. And this film makes me think similarly.
Oh, that's a great quote.
Philadelphia Story, you have unexpected depth.
Unexpected depth.
Because it really does start off lightly and humorously, and they talk about situations like alcoholism, affairs, situations that are heavy situations, and they treat them, you know, just like, oh, whatever, it's normal, you know, they laugh about this, that's fine. But as Tracy's mask begins to crack, these situations begin to feel more painful.
Yeah.
In some of those conversations with Dexter.
Yes.
That's some really masterful storytelling to be able to make that transition.
Mm-hmm.
And have it still feel believable.
Yes.
Because I've seen movies do that where they start off funny and they try to make it serious and the tones don't match. But
right.
This matches well. And I think that's a work of art to be able to do that in a film.
Yeah.
To write a script where you can start off where everything's just funny and light and then those same things get turned around and flipped on their head.
Yes.
Another thing I liked quite a bit
yes.
this time, and I'm all about women supporting women. That's not always happening in films.
Oh, in this film, they're fantastic. The women are fantastic. I would be any one of these women.
Yes. And there's this great moment at the end when Mike is proposed to Tracy. And Tracy says no. And the reason she gives is Liz wouldn't like it.
Liz wouldn't like it.
And, you know, so often in film, women are pitted against each other because they want the same man. And that storyline just gets so tired and old for me. And especially in the 40s. That was the storyline often. That was the only role women had to play. And this movie shines as being so different. And, you know, we see early on, Liz is observant.
Yes.
She knows that Tracy can charm men.
Yes.
And, you know, she's getting her nails done when she
yes.
sees Mike and Tracy walk by. And you get the sense of it hurts her, but she kind of toughens up.
Well, she says, the manicure says, does it hurt? And she says something like, a bit, but I can handle it.
And so I thought it was a nice turnaround of the situation.
Yes.
That it wasn't just, I'm not marrying you because I don't love you, which I think that was the case, but to specifically call out, no, you actually have something going on with Liz, and I respect her enough.
I respect her enough to do this. And, you know, Dinah, in her own way, is looking out for Tracy as well. Dinah, the little sister,
likes Tracy.
You know, she gives her grief all the time, like a little sister does, but she says, you know, oh, I just hate that you're leaving us, right? You're going to get married and leave us again. But she knows that Dexter is good for her. She's kind of plotting against her, but for her own good, right? And even the mother figure, who's a very complicated figure,
she is
trying to hold this family together in the middle of a crisis.
Mm-hmm.
They're very strong female characters in this. I've always appreciated that. But yeah, if I had to pick one of these women to be, I want to swim like Tracy and I want to be like Liz.
Well, okay, so clearly there's a lot we liked. What didn't work?
This is the thing that breaks my heart about this film. There are some concepts in the film that are now so dated they are practically appalling.
Such as?
Mainly, there's this awful speech that Tracy's father gives to Tracy where... they're trying to double down on this goddess, this contemptuousness that she has, right? It's another male voice in her life telling her this. But the way he does it is he literally blames his philandering on the lack of his daughter's compassion toward him.
Yeah.
Okay, not buying it. No way. Nope. I wish I could kick that thing out of this film. It's just so much of this male gaze. I can't stand it. As a kid, when I was a kid, I remember thinking, that's weird. That doesn't make any sense to me. Like, it didn't go in.
Yeah.
But it just felt unjustified. Although, you know, what the character's saying is similar to something that Olympia Dukakis's character says in Moonstruck, right? Hmm. She says that men of a certain age cheat because they fear death, basically, right? It can be true, I think.
Yeah.
And he's trying to say the same thing, like, hey, as men get older, we're vain and we want to hang on to our youth. But then he turns around and says, and you, daughter, if you had treated me differently, I would still have my youth and I wouldn't find the need to go off and cheat on your mother. It's
gross.
Absolutely appalling. So when, oh, when will men stop blaming women, the women in their lives, for their own infidelities?
Right.
Please, gentlemen, we're in the middle of the Me Too movement. Stop.
Yeah.
Because it has nothing to do with us. It's your own stuff. Deal with your stuff.
Yeah. Well, I even found, so nothing to do with film, but speaking to this point, I spent some time in the Middle East, and I met with women who would cover up. Sometimes they would wear burqas. Sometimes they'd wear head coverings.
Yes.
And even then, that didn't protect them from...
Right.
Abuse from men in public. Like,
right.
Not like men in their lives, but like just strangers on the bus. And heard horrifying stories of women who fully covered and guys were still acting lewdly towards them.
Yes.
And
yes.
That's the moment when it really became clear to me, oh, no, it's nothing to do with women. It's all about men and a desire for power.
Yeah.
And it really made things clear for me in terms of whose fault it is there. So, yeah, like you, I have little patience for when women get blamed. The men in this movie, especially her dad, need to take responsibility.
Yep.
For their own lack of commitment.
That's right.
Yeah.
For their own fear of aging, deal with it. Right.
Yeah.
There's another choice. You don't have to go have an affair. You can deal with the fact that you're getting older, like all of us have to.
Yeah.
Some other concepts that are troublesome in this film is like Tracy driving around drunk.
Yes.
Like, are we just going to talk about like she?
I know.
Like, please stop.
When Mike goes out to the car, I was like, oh no.
Oh no.
One of the two of them is going to drive, and they're so drunk
right now. It's like, oh, no big deal.
Yeah. Or I mean, let's talk about the opening.
Oh, the
scene
opening
of the film.
Scene. I know.
And Dexter shoves her. He doesn't punch her gratefully, but
it's
played for laughs.
Yeah, so, I know.
And it's hard because there's a few movies that come to mind for me when I think of this whole dynamic of, wow, things are really different back then. I think of Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Yes.
When you have Mickey and Minnie playing an aged man.
Oh,
that's horrifying.
Oh, so awful.
Or I think of Holiday Inn, which I love Holiday Inn.
Oh, that blackface sequence.
They do a blackface sequence
so
when they're celebrating Abraham Lincoln, and it's horrifying. You're like, and it's hard because I love that movie, but every time that scene comes on, I'm gritting my teeth and like almost going into a mild panic attack, like, oh gosh, this is so awful. Although, interesting moment, there's a point when they ask Mike if anything happened with him and Tracy.
Yes.
And he goes, well, there's rules about that.
He says, you were a little the worse for the wine, and there are rules about that.
So even despite all of this.
I know. I thought about that, too. Like,
yeah.
Mike, you're like, you get what we're still trying to work on today with men. That should be the rule. So, yeah, and you're right. What is interesting about films of this age, what I think we have to do is, because you're not going to change them, but you need to take note of how far we've come and maybe use that as an opportunity of conversation for someone who you're introducing the film to. Like, yeah, it can be shocking. It's like when I watched Mad Men and thought, oh, right, that was only a few decades ago.
Yeah.
When, you know, they were smoking in offices and drinking all day and patting their secretaries on the butt. Like, it's important for us not to forget, but it's also important for us to frame this in a new way. And it doesn't mean that you throw out the baby with the bathwater.
No.
There's still very profound things about this film, and it is a beautiful love story.
It is. And a really powerful story for women.
Yes.
Especially in a time when that was not happening on film.
No, it wasn't. And let's talk about really quick the backstory of talk about powerful women. Katharine Hepburn was considered box office poison before she did this film.
Really?
Yes. She was put on a list that they said box office poison. She went back to Broadway. She was on Broadway. She starred in The Philadelphia Story. Howard Hughes helped her buy the rights to the play so she could go back to Hollywood and say, I will sell you these rights for this amount of money and so that I will be in the film and I will have first choice of actors and director.
Wow.
This was unheard of at the time. Katharine Hepburn is that strong woman.
And she clearly chose well.
She chose
well. I mean, the director she chose, the actress she chose.
I mean, if you think about it, you can see George Cukor, you name all these men, but it was Katharine Hepburn. And Howard Hughes helping her up. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for your support.
We need men as allies.
We need men as allies, right? But she's really the force behind this entire film.
Wow.
I could go on, but we should probably end this for now. So those are our current thoughts on The Philadelphia Story. We hope this stirred your imagination and love of film. For as you can see, particularly with this film, like the psalmist said, by God's light, we see light.
We would truly love to hear your thoughts.
Please.
Yes. So our Twitter handle is @KeyPodcast. Or you can find us on Facebook @KeyPodcast. We try to keep that nice and simple for you. You can also find us on iTunes and other major podcasting apps. If you like what you hear, we'd appreciate it if you leave a review.
Thank you.
Because that actually might introduce other listeners to our podcast, which
yes.
would be wonderful. And if you don't like what you hear, please keep it to yourself.
Yeah, or stop listening. That's fine, too.
That works.
Our in and out music is by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com. So that's it for this episode, and we hope you'll join us next time for more stories in the key of light.